history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. Stories that, if we take the time to listen, might just add to our perspective. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve those stories of theirs so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we're always educated, we're always entertained, and so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, you're going to develop a picture of the price of freedom from three men who contributed to it in a multitude of ways. Three men who served in three different branches of service during World War II, who grew up in three different U.S. states, Pennsylvania, Oklahoma, and California, who all had very different experiences, but without question, all developed a life-changing perspective on the price of freedom. Price and value are two different things, and this week we have perhaps our most important method of making sure the value of our freedom matches the price that was paid for it by exercising our right to vote. These men fought to defeat tyrannical regimes and preserve our system of government and the freedoms and ideals it seeks to uphold. I thought that would be a good focus ahead of Election Day, and I hope by the end of the hour that you might feel the same way. The first veteran you're going to hear from is Ruben Ramirez, who served with the Blue Devils of the 88th Infantry Division in Italy. He would be wounded three times and suffer an even greater loss than that, as you'll hear. But we're going to start with how he experienced December 7th, 1941, and the first day of war for the U.S.
Three other friends of mine, we were all in the downtown theater in Los Angeles. They announced, they stopped the movie and announced that what had happened to Pearl Harbor and everything else. So they cut the movie and started playing patriotic music, and everybody and the people were just crowding and running outside, you know, with excitement of it. But we just looked at each other and said, well, I guess there's going to be a war. Although we, as kids, we would go to the library and read all about World War I, about the fighting and the airplanes and all that, and then we'd go to a movie. So when that hit us, we were kind of excited about it. We didn't know if we were going to be involved into how deep we were going to be involved.
So your older brother goes in shortly thereafter, and I guess you probably had some time still to finish up high school?
I didn't finish high school. I dropped out 11th grade. And I went to work. When I came back, I finished my GED testing and everything. I passed that with good grades and everything. I regretted dropping out afterwards, but what was done was done.
Well, I'm curious what it was like to still be here in the States and know your brother was heading overseas. Were you concerned for him? Were you worried about him? Did you keep in touch with him? What was that like?
We more or less kept in contact, and whenever he was assigned to camps around California along the coastline, he was in St. Louis Obispo, Fort Ord, other places that we could travel to. We'd all pile into the car and go and spend a weekend with him.
Kind of sounds like you looked up to him.
We were close. We were very close. His nickname was Hank. His older friends always called me, "Here comes little Hank," because I was like hanging onto his coattail, going to the baseball games and everything. And he took care of me pretty good.
Did you sign up because he was already in, or did you wait to get drafted yourself?
I got drafted. I was 18 in July of 43, and I was in the Army November of 43, so 3 months after my birthday. Went to Camp Roberts, got trained there and everything. Finished my training, we got a 30-day leave, R&R at home, and then we reported to Fort back east, and we got it re-outfitted and everything else. All the group that I trained with at Camp Roberts, we all reported there, got outfitted and everything, and we were there about 2 weeks, and they started calling, fall out in the parade grounds, and they started calling names to get on board trucks. Everybody got on the trucks except me. I was the only one left in the parade grounds, trying to find out where I was supposed to go, and I told the sergeant, "What am I going to do?" He said, "Well, I can't find your name on the list. I can't find your number on the list." So he checked with another officer and up the line, and they finally found my records at the Field Artillery headquarters. So I had to wait. Everybody that shipped out that day went to England, and I had to wait for 3 weeks for another batch of people to come in. we assembled to go out, and we got shipped to Italy, which was a 23-day trip over to the Atlantic. Newport News, Virginia to Naples, Italy. It was 23 days in a convoy.
And I want to hear about that. And I know you didn't have it easy. Three Purple Hearts certainly illustrate that. But have you thought about what would have been different had you not been left behind there? Had you gone over to England with everybody else?
I met one of my friends afterwards, and his report was a lot of most of them were killed, a lot of them were captured, a lot of them were wounded. There were very few that survived because they were in the main invasion.
So the guys you trained with are guys that were hitting the beaches of Normandy on June 6th?
They were in Normandy, and they were in the first wave, the way I understand it.
So that would have been you, and you and I wouldn't be talking right now.
Exactly. Well, there were survivors, but who knows? God only knows what would have happened. Rome was captured on June 4th, I think it was. Shortly thereafter, I joined the division as a replacement.
This is the 88th Infantry Division.
They were offline at that time. I joined the squad, which was Company E, 349th Infantry Regiment. They assigned me to be a BAR team leader. Myself and two other men carried the ammunition, carried the BAR, which weighed about 19.25 pounds, and protected the flanks or whatever the firepower was needed. We were fighting out in the open, and I don't know how I got hit because I didn't feel anything. There was excitement of the fighting. I didn't know it was hit until I started feeling my shoe so wet inside. And I looked down and I seen blood coming out of my boot. And I called for a medic. They patched me up, sent me back to the aid station. From there, they sent me to the hospital. But I didn't know I was hit until I felt some pain and felt my shoe all soggy. It had been raining, so I figured it was bad because of the water. But when I checked it out, my socks was all red with blood. And it got me back to the aid station.
Did that get your attention at all? Did that make you feel a little more susceptible or vulnerable?
Definitely, because artillery has no conscience. It can hit way over here. You can be over here and a little further away from where it hits. But a shell breaks up into so many little pieces, big pieces and little pieces, that anyone can hit you. That's what hit me on my ankle, a piece of shrapnel.
So you're in the hospital recuperating, trying to get better so you can go help your buddies some more, and you get word from home that your brother has been killed in this same war.
Yeah, that was notifying me that he had been killed.
That had to be devastating for you. I can't imagine what that felt like.
It was very devastating. Yeah. Well, the staff was real good. You know, they understood. So they kind of left me alone in my sorrow. But they were all understanding, and they took care of me, you know, to my benefit.
And I know you had plenty of motivation already. I mean, you had a clear purpose you were fighting for. The world was at stake here, but I imagine that made it more personal for you. Did that give you more motivation to win this war and also more motivation to make it home to your family?
I'm motivated to be safer, to keep them out of danger as much as possible, but it's impossible to say, well, I'm not going to go out there because I know they're going to be shooting there. You had to do it. You had to continue the war as it was as a fighting soldier. You had to go out and do it again.
So you heal up and you go back to your outfit, back on the BAR?
Yep, still go back. They saved it for me. Two different people were assigned to me because the other ones had been wounded too earlier. So we separated and then never came back to the squad. So when I went back, they put me in my same position as a BAR team leader with two new men that I have to, you know, get reacquainted and trained and to see what kind of action that they would be giving or what kind of backup they could give you. But you have to depend on your teammates.
And I mentioned that was only the first of three times that you were wounded during the war. What was the second?
Again, shrapnel. We're in a firefight and the Germans were in front of us and there was a valley to the back of us and we were in the hillside looking down in the valley, but the fighting was in a town which was in front of us. We were in the crest of the road of the hill, and their shell was hitting down there in the valley because our troops were moving up on that side. And I was in a hole upstairs looking toward the town where the enemies were. And my friend, my mates there, jumped out of the hole hollering that he was wounded, jumped out of the hole, and I seen that a hole about the size of a fist out of his calf was gone. you know, from where the shell hit, where shrapnel hit him. And he got out of the hole. I pulled him back down, hollered at the sergeant. The sergeant said, well, the aid men are busy, so get him and take him back to the aid station, which is about 150 yards in a farmhouse to the other side. So I got him and calmed him down and got him in a fireman's carry and started down and away from the crest of the hill so that the enemy won't see me until I got into an open field. And then we were running across the open field when I felt a pain in my hand and in my thigh. And I fell down and I told the guy, I'm dropping the packs here, because we were all loaded down with packs. So it says, so, and then we'll make it the rest of the way. But in that time, there was sniper fire coming at us. So he said, we got to get up and get out of here. So we finally got him into the aid station and they took care of him right away. And then they asked me if I wanted some dry socks to take back to the guys. I said, yeah. I said, yeah, because my shoes are all wet and full of water. And again, I took off my boot and the blood had run down my leg. And they said, okay, let's take a look at you. So the aid man looked at me and said, no, you're not going back out. I lost my pack. I lost my souvenir pistols. Lost everything that I had in a pack. A personal being, you know, things.
You had left that in the field just trying to make it there, right?
Yeah, so somebody else picked them up and got the pistols, and I hope they shared whatever it was, what they wanted. Because, you know, it's all personal stuff that you pick up along the way and you keep for little souvenirs. But I had taken a .32 caliber Walther off of a German officer. Earlier, when we were walking up the road and there was a farmhouse, the lieutenant tells me, take your team, go and check out that farmhouse. Wait, they're walking in the road. So when we get over there, we start hollering if they're in there to come out in English, you know, and in German, comes to say here, you know, try to make some kind of communication. So two soldiers came out with their hands up, and we took them aside, and then we start saying, anybody else in there? And then this officer walks out with his hands up, and two other soldiers come out with him. So there was five people in there, and there was only three of us. But when he approached me, I told him, you know, in front of me, we started searching down. I got the pistol off of him, and I lost that. That was a personal thought to having it.
The thing that strikes me, and I know you're not patting yourself on the back, you're just telling me what happened, but so often we hear these kind of stories, and when you're in that situation, you do what you hope the other guy would do for you. But I'm struck by a verse in the Bible. It says, greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friend. And you almost lost your life trying to save someone else's.
Well, it happens like that, but you don't give that a thought, though. You do what you have to do, especially somebody wounded like that, because he was really hurting and he was bleeding good, and I just had to get him over there. There was no other thought of doing nothing else but getting him there.
So you've told us about two times being hit by shrapnel, and neither time did you really realize what had happened to you. What about the third? What were the circumstances there?
Oh, it was a shrapnel from a mortar. We were online on advancing, but we stopped at a farmhouse. Some of the guys went into the farmhouse. Some of the guys went to the barn to get some rest, to cook up things, clean up, or just relax or something. And I told my sergeant, well, I'm going to go over to the house to see some of the guys. So I was walking across the barnyard when mortar shells came in there. And I was in the middle of it, so all I did was take off. And I just ran to the house and got in there. And then I told the guy again, you better check me out because I feel some blood running down my leg. He looked and said, well, I can't tell if there's any metal in there or not, but you're bleeding pretty good. You're going back to the hospital for x-rays to make sure. Patched me up, put me in an ambulance back to the hospital, took x-rays, kept me for a couple of days, sent me back because they didn't find no metal in there. You know, they just sewed it up and sent me back in a few days. I got a few days rest out of it anyway.
It makes me wonder what all that did to your outlook, because here you are, your brother's been killed in this war. You've been wounded three times. Moving on from there, were you scared that the next time was going to be worse, or did you feel like, you know what, nothing's going to happen to me if I can take care of all of this?
If you say that you're not scared, you're crazy, because you have to be scared no matter what. You anticipate, if it's going to be combat, you know, you start the fighting. You have to anticipate, is one going to hit me now or later or what's going to happen? But to say that you're not scared, it's just a poor saying that no one realizes what you're in. I say I was scared, and everybody tells you that they weren't scared in combat. I'm not going to say they were liars, but...
Tell me about the Apennines campaign. What was the fighting like? What were the conditions like? Because I've heard some pretty awful stories about the weather conditions, the terrain, the enemy. How did you experience that?
Once you got out of the Po Valley and into the mountains, you're fighting rain, you're in fog, you're in total black darkness. You don't know where they're at. They know where you're at. They're up higher and they can see where we're progressing along the roads, because you have to stick to the roads, and there are very places that you can get away from track climbing a mountain. But the worst experience was being up in the mountains, and you're on guard duty at midnight, pitch black. You can't see your hand in front of your eyes, like in front of your face, and then it's foggy. You hear the water dripping off of the leaves, making noises. Your senses become acute to hear what kind of noise are you hearing. You can't see anything, but you hear a particular dripping on this side or rustling or on that side. I mean, I was scared of the dark. I have to sleep with a nightlight. I have to sleep with light. If I fall asleep when it's dark, when I wake up, I get a panic attack. The worst part is I make sure the lights are on.
That's something you've just had to live with ever since the war?
Yeah. I sleep with the lights on outside. I sleep with the nightlights inside. It's something you can't say, turn it off. You can't turn it off.
Wow. Do you feel the price of freedom a little more deeply now? That is Ruben Ramirez. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, another veteran who also lost his brother in the war and has his own incredible story of survival. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and I know anyone and everyone has been reminding you to exercise your right to vote. But when we all understand what so many have endured to preserve that right, perhaps it sinks in a little more deeply. Like the last veteran you were listening to moments ago, Ruben Ramirez, Francis Asbury had an older brother also serving in World War II. Francis was in the Navy, serving as a radio man and gunner on PB-4Y-1 and PB-4Y-2 bombers with VPB-106 in the Pacific. Just try to imagine being in his shoes as you follow along with what he survived in World War II.
I never wondered I'm going to get killed or something like that. Like I say, I guess I was too dumb and happy to realize what was going on, and I knew we had to do something, and you just did it. After we were in New Guinea, a little island called Wadki,
yeah,
we did our last bombing right in there and had bombed that little island before we landed there.
Uh-huh.
But that was our last trip. We came back to the States and had to leave and went up to Hutchinson, Kansas for about 6 weeks. Then went back to San Diego and reformed the squadron. What they did, they took half the squadron and created two new squadrons. And then we went back in September or October of 44.
With new planes, right?
We had new planes, but that was our problem when we went down, because we were flying an old B-24 that had a lot of hours on it.
Ah.
And what they were trying to do is to save hours on our new planes.
What was the purpose of you going up in the B-24 that day?
They were doing patrols out of there, so we would just on regular patrol.
Looking for submarines or ships or something?
Ships, mainly.
Do you remember the date?
That we went down? I never forget it.
I didn't think so.
December 19, 1944. We were out probably a little over 300 miles from Hawaii. The number one engine caught on fire, and we obviously were going to have to go down. And I'll tell you a story, and you can... I had a real good buddy on there, and when we found out we were going to go down, we all had life jackets. And he came up to the flight deck, and he said he didn't have one. I mean, we didn't have a spare. We looked around and couldn't find another one, and later on we did. And instead of staying at the radio, I had my second radioman get on, and I took the life jacket back to him in the back, and I was standing up when the plane hit. So I have no idea how I got out. I must have gone out head first.
So I want to get a sense for this being on this plane, because you've flown all these missions, and as you're telling me, you really haven't had any scares.
No.
Right? You haven't run out of gas. You haven't had any rough landings. You haven't been shot at, really, by at least not by enemy aircraft, maybe from ground fire.
Any aircraft.
So you're getting the ack-ack from down below.
Right.
But you hadn't been shot up?
We only got hit once really good. We had a hole in the tail about that big around.
About 18 inches in diameter?
Yeah.
That's big enough. That's getting hit pretty good.
Well, apparently the shell went through and did not explode.
Good thing, or you wouldn't be here.
That's right.
So that had happened. That was your closest call to this point.
Right.
But now you're in this B-24. The engine's on fire. And is your captain on the radio telling you to prepare to evacuate?
No, no, you don't bail out.
You're going to try to make a water landing.
You have to.
Uh-huh.
When you're over water that far out, you don't ever bail out.
Uh-huh.
You'd have 11 guys strung over 11 miles.
All separated.
All separated.
Yeah.
It's your only chance of survival is to stay together.
So he tells you, prepare for a crash landing on the water. But you figure out there's not enough life jackets, and your good buddy didn't have one.
Yeah, and I figured I had time to take it back to him.
And what was his name?
Red Vandergriff.
So you go from the top turret to where?
Back in the back part of the plane.
Toward the tail.
Yeah, by the two turrets, two open 50s.
So you've just handed him the life jacket, and you don't have time to prepare for crash position.
Handed him the life jacket, and that's the last I remember.
You just blacked out. So the plane hits, and you're basically knocked unconscious.
Oh, yeah.
So you have no idea how you made it from inside the tail of that plane to the water?
No idea.
Where were you when you came to?
I was in the water, and I saw the life raft, and Red was in it, and I was able to manipulate and get close enough, or he was getting close enough to me, to where he could pull me in.
Wow.
Actually, really being hurt, I was the only one on the plane that was hurt. I'll take that back. We lost 8 guys out of 15.
Oh, you had 15 that day?
Yeah. We had 4 guys that went over aboard ship, and they had not had in their 4 hours of flight pay. You got to fly 4 hours a month in order to earn flight pay. So they went up in order to get 4 hours.
Oh.
Yeah, 3 of them went down with the plane,
uh-huh.
And 1 of them got out.
So of the 15 on board, 8 are killed. And you come to, you're floating in the water. I mean, if you had taken longer to come to, you might not be here, huh? You had a life jacket that was keeping you afloat?
I had a life jacket on.
I mean, did you even know what had happened or who you were or where you were?
Oh, yeah. I knew what was going on, and I knew we were down and that we were in trouble.
So you see Red in the raft, and you're able to kind of paddle your way over?
Mm-hmm.
But you're hurt. You can already feel that there are some injuries.
Oh, yeah. I've got my face smashed in. I can't see out of my right eye. I've got a broken arm, compound fracture of this arm, and I lost a lot of teeth.
Lost a lot of blood, I bet.
Probably, yeah, lost a lot of blood, but mainly it was my face and this compound fracture of this bone and this bone here to where?
Around your eye, the orbital bone?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
So my eye sunk down, but there's compound fracture of both of them. And my nose, my upper jaw was shattered, my lower jaw was shattered.
So basically, your face looks like it got sledgehammered.
Yeah. I'll show you some pictures.
Well, I'll make sure we put those at hometownheroesradio.com so everybody listening can look at them. Could you feel all that pain, or were you kind of numb to some of it?
Actually, I was numb, really. The only thing that hurt was my arm. Anytime I moved it or anybody touched it, it hurt. As far as my face and all these bones that were broken in there, I had no pain.
Wow.
It's amazing.
So you get to the raft, and Red helps you into it?
Oh, yeah.
And can you see anybody else?
You can see the other guys hanging on the side.
Of the raft?
There were always three of us in the raft. I was in the middle and one on each end. It was only a two-man life raft, really.
But they put you in the middle because you were the most severely injured.
Yeah. The other guys hung on the side.
Uh-huh.
And then they all took turns switching around over a couple of days.
And what time of day was it when you crashed?
Very nice day.
Middle of the day, like afternoon or something?
I would say very early afternoon.
Uh-huh.
Right afternoon.
I imagine you had some perspective on this. Because you've already done a whole tour in the Pacific flying these patrols where you're looking for enemy ships and you're looking for submarines. And I imagine occasionally you were looking for downed American airplanes, right?
Yes.
Now you guys are a downed American airplane.
You're right.
So you're dependent on someone who had been doing what you were doing to find you.
Hopefully.
Well, and that's my question. How much hope did you have? Knowing what you'd seen and what you were familiar with, did you think you guys would get picked up?
Absolutely not. When you're 300 miles from land in a two-man life raft, three-man life raft, you don't expect to get picked up. You're just lucky when you get spotted.
If you get spotted.
If you get spotted, you're just lucky. We didn't have any sharks, fortunately.
But you didn't know that.
No. But our hope was just being picked up.
When the sun set that first night, was that kind of a downer?
Yeah, I guess so. You're just sitting there wondering, are you going to get spotted?
Had the pilot had time to send out an SOS?
Oh, yeah, we sent out.
Or you probably did, huh?
I had, and then my radioman continued. Yeah, they had a pretty good idea of where we were at the time, except one thing was bad about it was a rough sea, and you really move around a little bit. I guess it was the 3rd. We went down on the 19th, and I think it was the 21st. We spent 2 nights out there, and then this Navy PBM happened to come by. We had a smoke bomb, lit the smoke bomb, and the pilot spotted it.
Wow.
His name was Glenn Welch. We actually contacted him after it was all over.
Wow.
The most beautiful sight in the world is being out there and seeing a plane several miles even with you and banked towards you. Then, you know, you got something going.
Yeah, this is incredible. And I've got a lot of questions for you. One on that smoke bomb. Did you have more than one, or was that the only one you had?
I'm not sure.
Because if that's your only one, you better make sure they see it.
That's right.
And you just told us, you said it very matter-of-factly, but this is a big, scary, insane deal. You spent 2 nights, overnight, twice, in the water, in this life raft, nothing to eat or drink, right?
Well, we had one can of water, and it was opened, and my second radioman took a sip of it. If you've ever taken a drink of water out of a can, you know it's not good. And he took a swallow of it and said it wasn't good, threw it overboard.
Oh, man.
Believe it or not.
Wow. And we all know what happens if you drink any of the salt water.
Oh, yeah.
You're just accelerating the inevitable.
Yeah, you don't drink that.
So overnight, 2 nights, in severe pain, all these broken bones, your face smashed in, your arm rendered unusable, not knowing if anyone's going to pick you up, and there were 3 of you in the raft and 4 hanging on?
Mm-hmm.
How did you guys get through that? What kinds of things were you talking about, or how did you support each other to survive that ordeal?
Well, there was a lot of quietness. I had a funny thought. When it came back from the first time, you don't have any place to spend your money overseas. So when we came back, I had pretty good chunk of money coming. And during that 3 or 4 months that we were back in the States, before we went back out, I spent a lot of money and I had a good time. And one of my main thoughts was that that was a pretty dumb thing to do because my parents didn't have a lot and they sure could have used that money.
Mm.
And then my second thought was, they're going to get my insurance. So it's okay now.
Wow.
I'm glad I spent it.
Were some guys starting to panic?
No, I don't think there was any. It was all pretty calm and very quiet. You're just sitting there listening, hoping to hear a plane. And the plane that spotted us could not land because of the rough water. And there was a radio ship pretty close by, I think. And anyway, from the afternoon, this weather ship got to us, and it was still daylight. because I have pictures of that. They got to us and picked us up, and then later that night, we transferred to a destroyer, and the destroyer took us into Pearl Harbor to the hospital.
As that time went on and on and on, and those hours dragged on and on, did you have that thought, maybe I'm never going to be picked up?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think any of us thought we ever would be, because, like I say, you got a small life raft 300 miles from land. What are the chances of finding it?
Yeah, that's beyond the needle in the haystack.
That's right.
And so were you resigned to not making it? Were you praying that you would?
Well, we were still hoping, yes. We were hoping that somebody would spot us. But you never give up hope in a situation like that.
And on Christmas Day, while your folks are back home in Oklahoma thinking they've lost a son, what are you doing?
I'm getting operated on.
They're trying to fix your face.
Mm-hmm. But fortunately, there was a nurse there that went to the same high school that I did, that she was about 2 years ahead of me in school, maybe three. But she was a nurse there, and she happened to be on the ward where they took me, and she wrote my parents and told them I was okay.
Wow. I wonder what your mother's face was like when she got that letter.
I have no idea. No idea. I was in the hospitals a year and a half.
A year and a half.
Yeah, but a lot of that was unnecessary because the doctor put steel plates in my arm and they didn't get the bones touching.
Ew.
And they have to touch in order to knit. So I ended up in Bethesda having three bone grafts and each one of them take a month to heal. So in between there and when we got back to the States, and my dad told me that my brother had been killed, then I went to the chaplain and the Red Cross and asked that I be sent to Norman, Oklahoma. Well, they sent me to Corpus Christi, Texas. And I was down there, I'm going to guess, probably a month. And I did the same thing. I went to the chaplain and Red Cross, told them my story. I said, I want to go to Norman, Oklahoma. And they made arrangements, and they sent me up there. But when I got there, there was no plastic surgeon. So I had to wait there for several weeks in order to be transferred to National Naval Medical Center in Bethesda, where they had plastic surgeons. So if you sit down and figure all that out, there's got to be 5 to 6 months in there where it really wasn't necessary because of situations.
I wonder, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth or thoughts in your head, but I wonder if it was good that you had that time to process everything you'd been through and what happened to your brother. And maybe you can help explain what happened to your brother. I know you didn't find out for quite a while afterwards, but he's a P-47 pilot.
Right.
Fighter pilot in Italy, where they did tons of bombing and strafing missions, flying every day, if not twice a day.
Yeah, he had 129 missions when he was killed.
He probably had some significant decorations, too, after all those missions.
He was decorated pretty good. And then, unfortunately, what happened was, at the end of 125, they could go home. And they asked for volunteers to do a few more flights. And he, unfortunately, volunteered. Mm. And if he quit at the end of his 125, then he would have been all right.
And by talking to guys who were in his fighter squadron, you were able to understand what happened to him that day? Explain that to us. What happened?
Well, they were out strafing, and they had some bombs on, and I don't know what they were bombing. But anyway, he had a bomb that hung up on his wingtip, and he also spotted this ammunition bomb, which he made a dive bomb on it, trying to shake the bomb off. And unfortunately, he shook it off. And he was down pretty low, and it exploded and knocked off his tail section. So he spun in. This was near Lake Garda in Italy.
Hmm. Is he buried there in Italy?
He was, and my mother raised so much cane with my dad, she wanted to bring him back to the States. So in 1950, we brought him back to the States. Buried him in Tulsa.
So that happened to him in February of 1945. But you didn't find out for a couple months after that.
No, I think I found out in April when I came back to the States from Hawaii.
What was that like to get that news?
Oh, that was probably the worst feeling I ever had in my life when my dad told me that. because we really were close. We were only 1 year. He was 21 months older than I was, but he was only 1 year ahead of me in school. And we did everything together. I was sort of the little brother, I guess. But that's the worst news that I have ever had in my life.
You know, and I often ask veterans to consider the odds or explain how they survive something. And you went through an unbelievable ordeal that the odds were against your survival. And you never would have married your wife. You wouldn't have had your three daughters. These grandkids wouldn't be here. And I'm sure you're thrilled about all of that, but I'm sure that's also tempered by what happened to your brother. Has that been hard to wrestle with over the years?
Oh, I've thought of him every day.
Every day.
Every day.
And I'm looking across. There's an open door here to your bedroom, and there is a big picture on the wall of an Army Air Corps officer.
That's him.
That's got to be Leon.
That's him.
Have you ever thought about what his life would have been like if he survived the war?
I've wondered, and you can't really wonder. I'm sure he would have been married and had a family, but what he would have done, I have no idea, but I sure wish I could have found out. It's the ultimate sacrifice.
Indeed it is. And in Leon Asbury and Hank Ramirez, you've heard about two of the more than 406,000 Americans who made that ultimate sacrifice in World War II. More than a million when you go back through all the wars in our nation's history. You've heard it from two recipients of the Purple Heart, and you're going to meet another who certainly understands both the price and value of freedom after living in the absence of freedom for the final months of World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, getting you ready for Election Day with a reminder to vote and a few reasons why that right should not be taken lightly, given the price that's been paid to preserve that right throughout our nation's history. For the final veteran you'll hear from today, it's that time of the year where his story always comes to mind for me. At hometownheroesradio.com, I have a link to the book 11-2, as in November 2nd, a key date on the calendar in several ways for Frank Kravitz. He had enlisted in the Army Air Corps on November 2, 1943, and exactly 1 year later, on November 2, 1944, he was ready for his sixth mission as a B-17 tail gunner with the 457th Bomb Group. Little did he know, his bomber would be one of 69 planes that the Germans shot down that day.
Well, we took off at 8 o'clock, about 8 o'clock in the morning. By the time we got rendezvous, our poop, and got in position for the bombing stream going to our target, we flew around at different altitudes, and we're just going around and around and around, you know. And once we got to 15,000 feet, while we were on oxygen, we were getting close to France or something like that, you know, where the Germans were. And we weren't on oxygen up till then. The anticipation comes when you see the black smoke coming up, if it's flak, you know. And somebody else ahead sees that, so they're telling us, you know, enemy fire up ahead, you know. So you got over 1,000 bombers in the air, a stream going in, you know. Yeah. So unfortunately, when our pilots, they opened the bomb bay doors and get ready for attack, and that, you know, we dropped our bombs and we turned off the target. And shortly after we turned off the target, we were attacked.
When you say attacked, you're not talking about the flak anymore. You're talking about German fighters coming right at you. And you saw them? Did someone else tell you they were coming, or were you the one who saw them?
3 o'clock high. Yeah. You know, I saw them coming.
How many of them?
Three abreast, you know. And I saw the cannon fire coming out of the wings for the last seconds, you know. And I fired back at them when I was still alive, you know.
And you shot one of them down?
I got credit for it. Somebody else in another crew said that the tail gunner shot down a plane. So that I have the citation for that, you know.
They give you a DFC for that?
No, I didn't get it. I only had six missions. That was the thing. And I never pursued. Probably should have had it, but I didn't bother.
Well, you had bigger concerns because you shot one of them down, but they were shooting at you. Tell us what happened to you in the tail of that plane.
Okay, when the second wave of planes came in, I was had my target on the planes, and all of a sudden there was an explosion in the tail end of the section, and it filled up with smoke. And, of course, being at that high altitude and the holes that were in the plane and everything else, the air cleared up real quick. So there I am, realized that I was wounded. I got on my throat mic, and I called it to the crew pod, tail gunner crew, I'm hit. I'm pushing on the button, the throat mic, and trying to report to them. I get no answer. As it happened, find out later on, this was all shot out, the whole communication system. So whenever the only way they communicated up front, the flight engineer were hollering back into the plane as loud as they could, giving orders and what to do. They chopped out the, this told them just later on. They got a hatchet and chopped the ball turret out and dropped that, threw all the ammunition out. They were throwing the ammunition out and everything else to lighten the plane up, you know.
Because you guys had lost three of the four engines, right?
Yeah. So this I wasn't aware of, but after our reunions and that, I was told about it. And another fellow had a video camera when we were doing it, and they all pitched in, and I had that document, which helped me write the book. They filled in the blank spaces that I, at that time, didn't know, you know.
Yeah.
My waist gunner, we came to a crossroad going down the road towards the farmhouse, and he's got his hands over his head with a German guard with a rifle on his back, you know. And I was on a two-wheel cart that they had gotten a picket fence and put it across the two-wheel cart, and that was my stretcher. So they're marching him down, marching me down to the place, and then we come to another place, and they took him one place, and they took me to the farmhouse. Well, my radio operator and another fella both have me laying on the floor, and they put sulfa powder on my wound, bandaged it, and put a big compress on it. Did stop the bleeding, you know.
And this is your left thigh, and you still have shrapnel in that left thigh, right?
Over 100 pieces.
I bet you're fun to go through a metal detector with.
No, it was an interesting story, too. My wife and I took them to some of her relatives had moved to California, so we took a trip to California. So I took my wife and three kids on a plane ride to California. We get off at LAX airport, and I let the children go through, and I let my wife go through, then I go through. As soon as I passed the thing, bells went off and horns were blowing and everything else, you know. And my family's waiting for us to greet them, you know. Two guys grabbed me by the arm. Would you step back and go through again? So I stepped back and I went through again. Now they really grabbed me and took me off to the side. You know, I says, what are you doing? What's wrong with me, you know? And my cousins out there, put them in jail. Put them, just, they were stupid, you know. So, we laugh about it all the time. Yeah. But they took me to a little room and they asked me to strip and everything else, you know. Yeah. I says, what are you looking for? I says, I don't have no pistols or guns or nothing, you know. You know, he says, well, you're ticking off the thing. I says, how about the shrapnel in my legs? So I says, I'll drop my legs here. I got over 100 pieces in my legs. So they put the thing up there, and that's what it was.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but now things are more sophisticated.
I'm sure your kids remembered that, too.
He said, John, well, what cops doing with their dad?
Well, you dealt with much worse interrogations than that, I know, too, and I want people to understand what the situation is here. So you're on this airplane that is barely making it, that is not going to make it, and there's a real chance you aren't going to make it. You're wounded severely. You can't get yourself out of this plane, so you needed your fellow crew members to save your life, right?
After they dragged me through from the tail of the ship into the radio room, which was like a cabinet, you know, so that they could talk, and you didn't have the noise in here in the radio room, you know. So when I was on the floor, they looks at my wound and everything, put sulfa powder on it, made compresses on it, you know, wrapped it real tight and gave me morphine and other sedatives. It was in the first aid kit, you know, and I was awake.
What was going through your head?
I had no idea. I don't. The thing is, things were happening, and I'd say to myself, all I was doing there is trying to remember what's going on, unconsciously, you know, observing everything that's going on. And that's why I have such a vivid picture of it. What's ahead, I don't know. It's just happening there. You're looking at it, and I remember it, you know.
So you couldn't walk. You couldn't bail out yourself, and the captain's given the order to bail out, right?
Yeah, the captain gave the order to bail out, and they took care of me first. And they got me over to the door, put the chute on me, popped the chute in the floor, and put it in my arms and tossed me out. I just didn't take long for the chute to open up, you know. Quite a jolt, by the way.
Well, yeah, so they actually pulled the ripcord before they pushed you out of the plane. So then it's opening immediately when you pop out of that plane.
Yeah. It was happening. I wasn't thinking about it. I guess my mind was just recording it, that's all.
So you had a pretty long way down to the ground. Were you conscious? Were you looking around you? What did you see?
At first, I thought I was going up. You know, and honest to God, I said, geez, this thing's going up, you know. And then all of a sudden, the ground started coming up to me, meet me, you know. And then there were dwellings around the area, and there was farms and everything else. So I remember that, you know. And then after I landed, I know where it was, you know. And I have one member of my crew that went over later, many years later, and he documented where our plane went down. Then when we had reunions, I had another fellow brought his video camera, and they all talked around, and we have a video of that, you know.
While all this was going on, did the thought enter your mind that you might not wake up another day, that this might be it for you?
No. I didn't think about death then, you know. I just was observing what's happening at now. That was the only thing I was interested in.
And what happened when you hit the ground?
I tumbled like a jackrabbit. I tumbled down the hill.
Yeah.
A few steps like that, because it was on a little hill like this, and I just boom, 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 boom. You know. I know their instructions were to hold your feet up and it's like you got, but easier said than done, you know, especially if you're wounded, you know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even think of that, you know.
Well, and I've talked to some POWs who tried to hide or avoid capture. Most of them, you know, maybe they lasted a few hours, but they were eventually captured. And in your case, there wasn't much you could do because you couldn't move unless you dragged yourself with your arms, huh?
Yeah. I had no motion at all. I had to be on a stretcher or a bed somewhere, and that was it, you know.
Who found you? What did they say to you?
There were two German members of the Wehrmacht, like sad sacks, you know. Not very neatly dressed, or, you know, they were doing a job, that's all they were doing.
But there was another situation here where somebody saved your life because there were some civilians you'd been bombing that wanted to take your life, right?
The civilians were coming in a distance, and they came close enough that I saw they had pitchforks and that in their hands, and that, and they threw, Germans fired a couple rounds, and they went back to where that house was that they eventually took me anyway, you know. Took me to the farmhouse where the Hitler Youth took him again.
So that night, you spent the night in a cow barn, unable to move, guarded by two members of the Hitler Jugend. I can't imagine what that felt like. And even after they got you to a hospital, you don't know how much they really want to take care of you. You don't speak their language. And there was a real fear that you might lose your leg.
Well, I said when I was on the table, and the flying nun that was just attending to the doctor, at the thing in the table wasn't more than 3 feet wide and about belly high, you know, where I was laying on, maybe chest high or right here, and none was looking straight at my face, you know. I don't know what the procedure was, but I know they put a container on my nose and told me to count, and I remember counting to about 100.
You wanted to know if they were going to cut off your legs, so you motioned?
The nun was beside me, and I made motions with my hand if they were going to amputate, and the nun says, nine. I already knew because my mother spoke German, so different words that I didn't know from that, you know. And I just had no thoughts more, but somebody's taking care of me, do with me what thou wilt.
But when you came to after that operation, what was the first thing you did?
Well, I took my hand, started my hip, and went down the side and see if I still had a leg. Because I thought the Germans were historically, amputations were the easiest way out. So that's what had happened, and I went down my leg and it's like that, and they patched me up the best they could, and I don't know what the drugs they used on me or anything else, but they comforted me enough that a couple of days later I was taken on a train to the interrogation center in Dulagluft for down flyers.
So they didn't amputate, they took care of you. So here you have a situation. A, the civilians basically have a lynch mob and they want to take you out, and these German guards shoot their gun in the air to save your life. And then these medical professionals save your leg and get you fixed up. Looking back now, how does that make you feel to know that these people on the other side of the war, your enemies, took such good care of you?
Well, I think later finding out that because we had been taking care of down German flyers, bringing them to the United States and taking care of them, they know what they got in the United States, German flyers here in the country, what good service they were getting. You know, I think that reflected back to us where we didn't get treated as miserable. What do you call it, camaraderie between flyers? Yeah. You know. So that prevailed.
So you spent a lot of time just healing up, but then you still had to spend time in a couple different prisoner of war camps. I know you were about 175 pounds or so when you went into the service.
When I signed up, I weighed 175 pounds. I had to be 170 to get into the Air Force. So I went back to my football coach, went down to the football field, and I worked out with a football team, you know, all during the summer with him. My stepmother's angry at me because I'm not eating. I don't want to eat. I just went on a diet, and I was determined I'm going to get in the Air Force, and I'm going to lose this weight, and I'm going to get in. So I did, you know.
A little more than a year after you were losing weight to get in the service, you were starting to lose weight, not by choice, because as a prisoner, you just didn't have much food. What was the worst of that? What was the hardest thing to deal with that element of your captivity?
Well, example to that is, I'll put it this way. One day, I was out there. They put me in an upper bunk because I'm not going to be ambulatory for a long time. They brought another down flyer in a bed next to me. We had our pleasantries, and he was in bad shape and everything else, you know. But we brought our food out. It was meager as it was, you know. I ate it, you know. And he's screaming, "I can't eat this crap," you know. I says, "Well, what are you going to do with it, you know?" He says, "You want it?" I says, "Yeah, I'll take it." They passed it over to me, and I ate it, you know. A couple of days of that, no more food came over. he needed it, you know, but that was a part of it. I said, give me all you got, you know.
Did you ever eat the infamous bread made out of mostly sawdust?
Did I? I sure did. In fact, if you give me your address, I'm going to send you, it was in our POW magazine, a copy of the ingredients.
The recipe, let me guess, there's a lot of tree flour, right?
Yeah. In fact, they use the outer bark, it seems like.
You didn't mind because it was something to eat?
Well, absolutely.
Did you ever think of escaping?
No, I don't think I ever did. With that many people, you know, guns are there, they're going to open fire on you. But first of all, there was a 10-foot warning wire inside and a 20-foot wire outside and barbed wire in that empty space. Now, many of the guys lost their life by trying to get through that maze because he got fired on right away anyway. And then the tunnel bit and everything else. I didn't see any of that kind of stuff, but it's historically, they did dig tunnels.
And how much did you weigh when you were liberated?
118 pounds.
So all these months, you're wasting away. You don't have enough to eat. You don't know when the war is going to be over or that your side's going to win. What gave you hope? Where did that come from? How did you believe that there was still a life out there for you?
I believed in the good Lord would take care of me. It's all whatever becomes of me. You never thought you were going to die, or for that matter. You know, you're living, so you live. And who knows when you're going to die anyway, you know.
And all this time, your family had no idea what had happened to you?
No.
Well, and obviously, the fact that we're sitting here talking, and the fact that that you have three children and five grandchildren. None of them would have been here if you didn't make it through all this, if you didn't survive, if you weren't eventually liberated. And sounds like there's a pretty good story about the day of your liberation and some things that you saw that you'll never forget. This was in Moosburg, Germany?
Well, I arrived at this camp from our long march from Nuremberg to Moosburg, Germany.
How long was the march?
90 kilometers. It took us about 15 or 16 days to walk, you know.
With anything to eat or no?
Yeah, we had whatever we could scrounge, you know. People, there were Germans that had potatoes, and if we somebody had something, could do a barter with them. Well, and whatever we saved to go on the trip that we had in the sack to sustain us, you know.
You're in Nuremberg, and you marched 16 days to Moosburg.
And when we got inside of Moosburg, why, it was already crowded from other camps being vacated, and the things, us men coming in, the prisoners coming into the same compound. So it ended up, historically, it says that they were over 100,000 all nationality prisoners of war, Germans, French, whatever, at this camp. And on April 29th, our senior officer in charge of the United States Army that were opposing the Germans that were protecting their prisoners, and they were about to release them, they sent a group to the German groups there, the white flags and that. They come back, and the Germans refuse. They're going to attack the camp. So, and we didn't know this, but that's the historically what it was, you know. So it was about 9 o'clock in the morning on April 29th that the fire started. Our tanks start coming down over the hill. We saw them, and then all kind of vehicles, you know, and so much fire, you know, was going. And I guess the confrontation lasted maybe about an hour and a half. And our people inside says, lay on the ground, get under the barracks, get it done, because the fire's going on. And you're hoping they're shooting at our troops, and we're getting the residuals of it, you know, from in the air, you know. Some fellas were hurt, you know, from it, you know. Shortly before noon, we saw the flag go up over Moosburg.
When you say a flag, this is somewhere where there had been a swastika flying, but the new flag was?
American flag.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then all the shouting and everything was going on, you know, and it wasn't shortly after that that Patton, our troops came up to the gate, and then Patton came, followed in right away and rode up on his big white tank, you know. Not white tank, but he looked like God anyway.
White gloves and pearl pistols, I'm sure.
Mayhem, you know, tears, you know, kissing ground and everything, hugging and everything else. And it said, we're going home, everything we could think about. And it didn't take long, though.
Just imagining or seeing in your mind's eye that American flag going up and Patton's forces coming through the gate brings all those emotions back for you, doesn't it?
Yes. I told the dear Lord, if I let me get out of this predicament that I'm in, I'll never complain in my life. And I've done that.
And if he didn't complain, what does that mean for the rest of us? Frank Kravitz, Francis Asbury, Ruben Ramirez, three World War II veterans whose memories underscore the incredible price that's been paid for our freedom. Our right to vote this week is something we could easily take for granted, but I hope that after listening to what they lost, what they sacrificed, what they endured, that the rest of us can live in such a way that builds the kind of value that may someday match the price. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler saying it one more time, freedom is not free.